This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you saw Saving Private Ryan, you probably remember the scene toward the end of the film in a bell tower where a Jewish private is stabbed to death by a German soldier. The private was played by my guest, Adam Goldberg. His other films include How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, The Hebrew Hammer, A Beautiful Mind, and Dazed and Confused. On TV, he had a recurring role on Friends and starred in the short-lived series The Street and Head Cases. He wrote and directed the new film, I Love Your Work. It stars Giovanni Ribisi as a young famous actor who's finding that being a celebrity isn't such a good life. In fact, the constant buzz of the media and fans is giving him a nervous breakdown. He thinks that one of his fans is stalking him. At the same time, the actor starts to envy the life of one of his fans who works in a video store, and the actor starts stalking the fan. Here's the scene where they first meet. The video store clerk is played by Joshua Jackson.
Look, I'm sure you hate this, but I just want to tell you that your work, it really means a lot to me. It's had an impact on my life.
Thank you.
This probably sounds crazy, but I I wrote you one of those letters a couple weeks ago.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. My name is John. John Eckhart.
Gray.
It's nice to meet you. Can you sign that? You know, I've never done anything like that before, but I'm a filmmaker. Well, a grad student for right now, but truly you are one of the few guys whose work actually inspires me.
Well, thank you. That means a lot to me. Thank you.
Yeah, you were in film school, right?
What?
You used to be in film school, right?
Yeah. I went to film school and then I became an actor. Yeah.
Adam Goldberg, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me ask you in your words to describe what the movie's about.
I think the film, at its sort of simplest level, is really an allegory, really, for the cliche, the grass is always greener on the other side. But to me, it's really largely about this guy who, in this case, is a movie star, but again, sort of, I'm using movie star as kind of a metaphor for something that somebody had always wanted to be, something that somebody had always wanted to attain, you know, a certain status, and kind of realizes at some point that he's made a bit of a Faustian deal and kind of wants to turn back time, and it's not everything that he bargained for, you know, so he thinks or feels, kind of deals with this in not the healthiest way, you know, kind of coupled with an increasing paranoia and self-consciousness and self-awareness, which is certainly also perpetuated by a kind of a real life, you know, invasiveness that takes place when you're, you know, in the public eye. He begins to kind of recoil, kind of go into himself, and specifically and ultimately becomes obsessed with this young couple, one of whom is a fan of his. And this fan, although in many ways he wants to become the movie star wants to become this fan, and this fan reminds him of a sort of a simpler time in his life, a sort of pre-fame kind of fantasy existence that he has kind of begun to live in, really, in a sense.
So what happens, in a way, is that this young star is afraid he's being stalked in the first part of the movie, but by the second part of the movie, he's kind of stalking this guy who works in the video store who wants to be a filmmaker. He's stalking this kind of regular guy who wishes that he was well-known and making movies. What made you think about this reverse stalking?
Well, it's twofold, really. I think the sort of germ, I guess, of the idea came to me when I myself was doing a television show. And when you're on television shows, it kind of doesn't matter how well-known you are to begin with. You get a series of what are really form letters, you know, dear fill-in television, you know, actor's name. Could I get an autograph headshot sort of, you know, kind of thing. And I looked at this very generic letter and I thought, you know, I wonder if this guy really does care. I wonder if he really does enjoy my work, you know, or if he's just, you know, sort of doing this because, you know, he writes down the name of every single person, you know, who he sees on television. And then I noticed that the return address wasn't far from where I was working at the time. And I thought, oh, well, it might be kind of funny and perverse to hand-deliver this autographed headshot to him, you know? And then I thought, wow, that'd be an interesting idea for sort of a genre movie or a thriller, you know, a movie star who, you know, stalks a fan, very simply. And so some years went by, and I moved to New York, and I started to imagine that this character, this movie star character was surrounded by all these people in New York, and he was no longer able to tell the difference between the people who were saying his name legitimately as he walked by them, which happens if, you know, you're recognizable. Oftentimes people will sort of mutter your name to a friend of theirs, you know, or if, in fact, he was becoming increasingly paranoid. And then the idea sort of blossomed from there that this was a guy who probably to begin with was predisposed to a certain amount of, if you want to call it paranoia or disassociation or perhaps even schizophrenia, and you know, again, took that kind of cliche, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean people really aren't following you.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Adam Goldberg, and he's an actor, and he also wrote and directed the new film, I Love Your Work. Now, you had a TV series that premiered this fall, and I thought, okay, this is it for Adam Goldberg. He's got his new movie, he's got the TV series. This is his year. It is the year of Adam Goldberg. And the series was canceled after two episodes, was it?
Yeah, but see, the thing is that that's exactly, I knew this was going to happen, and everybody says, oh, you're being so cynical. Oh, no, it's not. Oh, no, this is going to be different. And I either have a sixth sense about these things, or I am, in fact, a curse. I'm not sure which. but I tried to tell these people, like, you know, and you know, because, you know, you're working on something and everybody's kind of, you know, really spirited and everything, and they can't wait to the premiere. And I said back in whenever, March or April, as soon as they, you know, gave us our time slot, which was up against Lost, I said, you know, well, they don't like us, and we'll be off the air in a matter of weeks. I didn't think it would be 2 weeks. Because I'd been through the same thing on the same exact network, literally in the same time slot, Wednesday, 9 p.m., 5 years ago on a show called The Street, which was a kind of, at the time, highly touted new Darren Star series. And
Stockbrokers, right?
About stockbrokers. Yeah. We all moved to New York, except for Tom Scott and Jennifer Connelly, who lived there. We all moved to New York to do the show. I wanted to move to New York, so I was, you know, looked at it as an excuse to move to New York, but... we were off, I think, five episodes later or something, and because at that time we were up against the West Wing, which was sort of the monster to go up against. One's kind of enthusiasm about kind of minor successes. For instance, you do a pilot, and, oh, the pilot gets picked up, and that's exciting. And it actually was exciting, because I was really looking forward to doing it. And, you know, and it's kind of sad because I know that I used to possess, which was a real youthful optimism about things. So you know, when the show got canceled, I was like, of course it did. And now I'll get back to my life, you know.
Well, you know, you say that you used to be more optimistic, but I think sometimes you can't afford to be optimistic because it leaves you too vulnerable. So you have to protect yourself by bracing yourself for the worst and
that's
expecting
what I told
the worst and telling everybody to expect the worst.
I did, and I would go around, and I would, like proselytizing misery, I would go around this on the set of this TV show, and I would tell people to stop it, you know, so you can enjoy yourself, enjoy your day, but stop talking about what the results are going to be, because you have absolutely no idea what the results are going to be, and you're going to feel so much better if the show does get canceled and you expected it to. And or if it's a success, you'll feel twice as good as you would have felt if you had expected it would be successful.
Let's talk about some of your earlier roles. In 1993, you were one of the stars of Richard Linklater's movie Dazed and Confused, which takes mm-hmm. place on the last day of high school, on the last day of a term of high school. And mm-hmm. I describe your character in this.
My character was, I think, largely a 1976 version of probably what I myself was like in high school. What's great about Rick's films is that I suppose typically you could say, well, we were part of the nerd clique or the geek clique. But, I mean, there's something else going on here, which is that this is a guy who's dying for visceral experience. You know, he's cerebral but can't stand that he's cerebral. And that's just that's something I could really relate to. You know, they spend the whole movie essentially driving around, and that is really quite literally how I spent my high school career.
Let's hear a driving around scene. And this is a scene where you're driving around with two friends. They're in the front seat. You're in the back seat.
Mm-hmm. Look, I got a confession to make.
What do you mean a confession?
Look, you know, for like the last year or so, I've been talking about going to law school so I can be an ACLU lawyer and be in a position to help people who are getting
over and all that. Well, I was standing in line at the post office yesterday, you know, and I'm looking around, and everybody's looking really pathetic. You know what I mean? I mean, like, people are, like, got drool just sort of staying, and then, like, this guy's bending over. You could see the crack. It was like, wife beaters. And I realized I just want to do it. You know what I mean? I mean, it sounds good and all, but I just have to confront the fact that I really don't like the people I've been talking about helping out. You know what I'm saying? I don't think I like people, period. I mean, you guys are okay. I'm just trying to be honest about being a misanthrope.
So you're not going to go to law school? What do you want to do then?
I want to dance.
That's Adam Goldberg in a scene from the 1993 movie Dazed and Confused. That's a really funny scene.
To hear
a cerebral guy like you say, no, but I want to dance.
Yeah.
Were you in high school productions?
Oh, yeah, I was. Yeah, I was definitely, you know, I went to a high school that really kind of prided itself on these, you know, big time, like sort of Rushmore like productions, and so yeah, I mean I did quite a few plays, which, you know, looking back is kind of amazing to me, because now if I step on stage I'm just completely paralyzed with fear. I mean, once I'm on the stage I suppose less so, but leading up to it, I mean the sense of nausea is so overwhelming. It's a mystery. I've managed to make it on stage a couple of times. I've had to since high school, but that's definitely where I guess began acting, if you want to call it that. Yeah.
Let's move on to the 1998 movie Saving Private Ryan, in which you played Private Stanley Mellish. And you were the Jewish soldier in it.
Yes, I was the Jew. Yeah.
And you had really what I think is one of the most memorable scenes in the movie, and it's toward the very end of the film. You're in a bell tower with a German soldier, and you're literally fighting each other to the death. Mm-hmm. Describe the scene from your perspective.
Yeah, this is a scene where a German soldier has me pinned to the floor, and I manage, I mean, I'm not quite sure how long it goes on, but it seems like it goes on quite a while in a sort of real-time sort of way, where we're rolling over, actually, the injured and dying body of a fellow soldier of mine, and, you know, I'll regain control, he'll regain control. And ultimately, I think it's my knife that
it's your
manages
knife.
To...
You pull out a knife as if you're going to stab him when you're on top, but then... He gets a knife, and then he's on top of you, and take it from here.
They've seen it more recently than me. and then he sort of starts speaking to me, and I kind of start speaking to him, and I'm sure he knows what I'm saying, because I'm saying, no, you know, please don't, you know, and he's saying something in German to me, which I took to mean, you know, just be quiet, just relax, you know, it'll be over soon. But it's this incredibly personal, you know. Oh, I'm sure. Maybe some psychotherapists have had fun saying that it was sexual. Let's say it's sexual. What the hell? He's on top of me. We're kind of whispering sweet nothings into each other's ears as he plunges a knife into my chest. You know.
Well, that's the thing. He doesn't plunge it.
Very slowly,
like a quarter of an inch at a time.
Right, that's right.
Puts that knife into your chest and your heart. And at first, as he touches the knife to you, we've all seen movies and we're thinking, well, you know, Adam Goldberg's going to wrestle the knife in his hand and he's going to be a top again and he'll win. But slowly that knife keeps going into you until you're dead. Yeah.
Expired, yeah. My mother, after she went to the premiere, I took her to the premiere of that movie, and I believe the first thing she said to me after the movie ended was, if you ever have a scene like that in a movie, please don't invite me. And I was like, okay, sorry. I think it was upsetting to many people, actually, have told me that it was very upsetting. It was actually a bit upsetting to shoot. However, I found it to be this very, very strangely cathartic process. First of all, the scene, initially in the script, I was supposed to die running. I was supposed to have been running and kind of randomly I'm shot and I'm dead and that was it. And over time, it developed into this kind of scene. And Steven had said that he'd wanted it to be very, very personal and very, very realistic. And I had said, too, that I really wanted to sort of speak and really probably do what I imagine I would do if I were in that situation, which is just to beg and plead for my life, you know. And he really encouraged that and really, really let the camera roll. Apparently, there's a much longer, sort of more gruesome version of it. But he had told me, Stephen had told me that at the, I guess when they were screening the dailies of it, that the projectionist who had seen everything Stephen had ever shot, he said, you know, just said, you can't put this in the movie. It's just too upsetting, you know.
When I was growing up, World War II movies were constantly on television. So I saw a lot of World War II films growing up. And they really scared the heck out of me. I know some people watch war movies and they think, when I grow up, that's what I'm going to do. But I watched war movies and I thought, like, I just can't imagine surviving this. I can't imagine having to endure war, either as a civilian or a soldier.
Yeah.
Did it affect your sense of war at all to participate in the making of, you know, one of the most, you know, praised and authentic-looking war movies ever made?
It affected me very, very deeply for a while, I have to say. I don't know. I mean, I'm a tad sensitive. And when I got home, it took me a while to even physically recover from the experience, which was not an easy experience, you know, just for essentially a pampered and privileged pansy little actor boy, you know. And it was, you know, a grueling physical experience. So you have that, and that kind of lowers your kind of emotional resistance in a way. And emotionally, I found myself being very, very connected to this thing of militia, military life, war in a way that I had absolutely no connection to in the past. But because we were acting these things out, you know, I felt very, very sympathetic towards, I guess you might say, the military, whereas in the past I had a very black and white kind of knee-jerk, you might say, liberal response to even the mere mention of the military or military involvement.
But that's one of the wonderful things I would imagine about acting, but also about watching movies or seeing books, is that it puts you in the position where you start identifying with and empathizing with characters who you would otherwise maybe not even meet or know nothing about and think of as being very different from you.
Oh, absolutely. That was one of the rare opportunities that I've had as an actor. Because frankly, I haven't had that many where I can say, "Well, I went and I was a fireman for 2 months." You know, I mean, that's not been the nature of my career. But this was something where I took this incredibly valuable lesson with me, and I felt incredibly fortunate to have had that. And it was really just more a sort of a slightly spiritual, kind of profound experience. And I'll tell you something else: is this the military advisor, this gentleman named Captain Dale Dye, who I think to this day, if I were to run into him, would just say hi, Captain Dye. I wouldn't say hi, Dale. And he, you know, we really were role playing, and at first it seemed ridiculous. You know, they put us in this boot camp, and we're not supposed to use our real names, and we're not supposed to refer to. We have to call this guy Captain. We have to call the sergeant, you know, his assistant sergeant, and this sort of thing. And at first, a guy like me thinks this is all ridiculous, you know, and a very strange thing happens by the end of this 5 day, after 5 days of, you know, sleeping in a pup tent. And that's just 5 days, right? Which is that I have an incredible amount of respect for this man, and all I want is to earn his respect. And finally, I felt I had, and he had said something like, he had tapped my chest, and he said, you know, you got more on that chest of yours than you give yourself credit for. Because I was having a hard time in the beginning, and I really had to work very hard to kind of get myself up to speed and up to snuff physically and all that for that part, and it was just as important to me throughout the duration of that shooting to impress and to be in the good graces of Captain Dye as it was, you know, Steven Spielberg. And that's, I think, when I fully understood this idea of the military as family.
I can think of at least you know, two movies where you played somebody who was Jewish, and being Jewish was an essential part of the character. There's Saving Private Ryan, and since you're fighting in Germany, being Jewish is an essential part of your character. And the other was an opposite kind of movie. It was an independent film that was a satire called The Hebrew Hammer. And you were this, like, Orthodox Jewish parody of, say, Shaft or a number of
Shaft,
other black exploitation films. And you were saving Hanukkah from what, Satan's son?
From the well, Santa Claus's evil spawn.
Okay.
Of course. And, I mean, come on.
So I want to ask you about how relatively important Jewish identity has been in your life. Though I should preface this by saying your father's Jewish and I think your mother's Catholic. So I suppose officially you're not Jewish, right?
Well, officially, I'm not. My mother, this is very important because my mother has seen this in interviews, you know, and she said, you know, please tell them I'm not Catholic. I'm like, so, okay, all right. So for my mother, she was brought up Catholic, and then, you know, then she became not Catholic, basically, whatever, you know.
Okay.
Then she became, what is that?
Just lapsed? Is that the word?
Lapsed Catholic? Gentile? Shiksa? I don't know. So... Yeah, the Jewish identity thing has become a more of a focal point of both, I guess, my career as well as my seems like the focal point of many interviews I do these days, and that's understandable. It's become, I think, a bit of a problem only because as you develop a career, you don't shape it. You know, it's not. I think people think that, particularly in interviews, a lot of times you'll hear that I'll read, not so much interviews that I do, but people will say, well, how do you choose these roles? And really, unless you're really, really, really a very powerful actor, and I mean like on a kind of a Tom Cruise level, you really don't have that much say in how you shape your career. You really, I mean, you can pass on certain things, but for the most part, these things kind of find you. And so one starts to lose track over a period of time of what their kind of oeuvre looks like, you know, or how it's perceived. And sort of, I swear to you, I woke up one day and I was like, my Lord, have I played a lot of Jews. And, you know, and I will tell you, this goes all the way back to... I mean, and I'll tell you something else. It doesn't matter if I'm playing a Jew or not. They think I'm playing a Jew. People think I'm playing a Jew in Dazed and Confused. I didn't know I was. The guy's name is Mike Newhouse. I mean, I don't know if that's a Jewish name in Texas. But the thing of it is that my last name is Goldberg. I look Jewish. I act Jewish. You know, and again, I'm doing air quotes here. But that has sort of been a source of a bit of a... I think a glitch, really, in my career. I mean, I'm sure that I have yet to... I've yet to have the opportunity that I had, let's say, in high school to express myself fully as an actor. I've given myself the opportunity to do so as a filmmaker, but certainly not as an actor, you know.
I am now going to blank out on the names of all the actors I'm referring to, but mm-hmm. during the studio days of Hollywood, there were a lot of Jewish actors who changed their names.
That's
and
correct.
No one knew outside of their friends that they were Jewish. And they got to play all kinds of
right.
of roles.
No,
and decades
right.
later, we find out that they were Jewish.
Right. Well, I will tell you this. I grappled with this a lot. I never wanted to change my name. I thought it was appalling that people change their last name. Right before Dazed and Confused came out, I suddenly was struck and with fear that this might be the nature of my career, you know. And I wanted to change my last name. And... considered it. I have a journal filled with potential last names from that era. Smith, Johnson, and White. But anyway, you know, in the end, when I actually finally made the call to, I think, my agent at the time, I said, you know, they already shot the title sequence, you know, which means it says Adam Goldberg as Mike. And I said, well, that's it. Because I knew this would be the film that would make me somewhat recognizable. But up until that point, I had just done, you know, a few television parts and that kind of thing. So, you know, I kind of just went with it from there. And, you know, you'd pick up a little kind of a Jew part here and there. And then, you know, before you know it, you're the Hebrew Hammer. Now, so when I got the script for, when I got the script for the Hebrew Hammer, I thought long and hard about this. And I thought, you know what? I can't fight this. And this is really funny. And it's a way to kind of, ironically, because in the movie, it's sort of a parody of these blaxploitation movies where they were really... kind of owning it, you know. They were owning the N-word. They were owning, you know, their own exploitation in a sense. And I thought, well, that's sort of metaphorical, even though this movie is a satire. I personally, Adam Goldberg, will own it and take it back. And then the next thing you know, you're on the cover of Time Out, and it says Super Jew. But the article, if you read it, says you're half Jewish, and you know, you weren't even bar mitzvahed, and you know, so it's like I find myself portraying myself as one thing and then saying, no, I'm not, you know, in interviews. And I think people have a certain perception about Jews, you know, they're fast talking, they're, you know, they're you know, fraught with neuroses and all this kind of thing. And hey, you know, that might be generally true, and maybe that is why I, maybe why half of me talks fast and is fraught with neuroses, and the other half is, you know, detached and cold. I don't know.
Well, one more question. Your new film, which you wrote and directed, is called I Love Your Work. Can people no longer come up to you and say, I love your work?
Well, the funny and, again, vainglorious thing about me is that while I was writing it and in the time that it's taken to get it out there, people have said that to me a few times, I love your work. And I forget, and I think they're saying the name of the movie. I think they're just saying, hey, I love your work. Like you know, hey, Saving Private Ryan or something like that. And then I remember that the film hasn't come out and it hasn't been seen. But so initially I was just flattered because of that, you know, and then I would walk away and I'm like, oh, no, the movie's not even out. And then recently people seem to be having fun because they've heard of it and they'll say it. And so they're having fun with it. So in that regard, that's fine, too.
Adam Goldberg, it was really great to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, a real honor. Thank you so much.
Adam Goldberg co-wrote and directed the new film, I Love Your Work. It opens in L.A. next week and a few weeks later in New York.